Thanks for listening to this special podcast of Weekends on All Things Considered. I'm Laura Sullivan, in for Guy Raz. A couple weeks ago, I took a walk with Robert Hammond and Joshua David. In 1999, they were two strangers who met at a community board meeting in New York's Chelsea neighborhood. Today, they are responsible for one of the city's newest and most popular public places, a modern high-concept park built on an old elevated rail line that runs along the west side of Manhattan. It's called the High Line. So if you get yourself there, to the corner of Gansevoort and Washington Street in the Meatpacking District, you can begin where we did and follow along with us as we walk the High Line for a rare guided tour with the two guys who made it all happen. They tell their story in a new book, Highline, the inside story of New York City's Park in the Sky. Here's Josh.
We're standing under the Highline at the southern end, at the corner of Gansevoort and Washington Street in New York City's Meatpacking District. And we're in an area that used to be very market-based with lots of meatpacking plants and food and produce markets, and has recently undergone a change and become more of a retail and restaurant destination. And over our heads, we're under this really massive steel structure with these heavy black steel beams covered with rivets where freight trains used to run over our heads. And they used to go through the buildings around here, and we can actually see, looking over there, a yellow brick building that used to be a refrigerated warehouse where the trains would actually go into the refrigerated warehouse and load and unload their meat and dairy and produce directly into this refrigerated environment. The parts of the High Line were torn down, and this is actually the cut of where everything south of here was torn down in a couple of times, once in the 60s, once in the early 90s. So up ahead of us to the north lies the 1.5 miles of the High Line that remains, going from 34th Street from Gansevoort Street where we are now all the way to 34th Street.
So for decades, I don't even know, for even 100 years even, freight trains would literally come through across this track, which is about as wide as maybe three cars, maybe a three-car highway.
Actually, a little less than 100 years. It was built in the 1930s. So there used to be trains before that, though, that ran on the ground, and that's why the High Line was built.
Why was the High Line built?
The High Line was built because there were trains running on the ground in this neighborhood, and they ran over so many people that the avenues around here were called Death Avenue. Death Avenue. And there used to have to be men on horseback wearing cowboy hats, waving red flags, that rode in front of each train, and they were called the West Side Cowboys. And that's, for many, many years, what they had to do to try and keep people from being injured. But then in the late 1920s, the state of New York, the city of New York, and the New York Central Railroad, which owned the railroad, came to an agreement to do something called the West Side Improvement. And that lifted all of the train, either lifted all the trains up in the air or put them down below the ground to eliminate those crossings. So the High Line was just one piece of a much larger transportation infrastructure project that was done in the early 1930s.
So then in 1980... the last load of frozen turkeys.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
So
what happened in 1980?
With the rise of interstate trucking, the High Line was used less and less. But it was still operational in the 70s, and it was servicing actually this neighborhood right here, which is the old meat market neighborhood. And the story goes that right before Thanksgiving, the last train ran, and it was a trainload of frozen turkeys. Coming from the meat market, or coming into the meat market, you know, to serve, to give New Yorkers turkeys for Thanksgiving. So, and then it was unused, and it sat basically abandoned, and that's when, we first both heard about it in 1999, the summer of 99.
So in the 90s, when you guys saw the High Line, and for every other New Yorker who saw the High Line, this is essentially what you saw,
yeah,
minus the staircase here,
yeah,
was this giant, hulking, black piece of steel running down the street above you.
And this is what I fell in love with, was the steel structure. Yeah, before I ever saw what was on top, I loved just this industrial relic, that you had this massive steel structure that I thought was ancient. You know, I was like you. I thought it was hundreds of years old. In reality, it's the age of my father, basically. But, I thought it was this old industrial relic, you know, from the past century. And so that's what I first fell in love with. And then once we went up on top, there was this whole other experience of a mile and a half of wildflowers. So, you know, that's where it really clicked, because you had this juxtaposition of this man-made steel structure of, you know, sort of the industrial history of Manhattan with a mile and a half of wildflowers that had just taken over. And the wildflowers seemed, you know, just as strong and just as potent, you know, as the steel structure. And those two things combined, to me, you know, that's what the High Line is.
Because a lot of people might look at this, I mean, minus the nice things that you guys have done here with the signage and the stairs, would look at this and say, this is kind of an eyesore. Why would we even want to keep this giant behemoth steel structure?
We definitely encountered that opinion. An extra challenge is there used to be a lot of pigeons roosting in here, and they would poop on you when you went underneath the High Line. And so that was actually the negative condition that people cited the most. It was that thing that the pigeons poop on you from. And it was, we've repainted it since that time, so it looked a little rustier. And so there were people who didn't really appreciate its aesthetic. And I think in traditional urban planning lore since Jane Jacobs' time, the idea of elevated structures that run through neighborhoods have often been viewed traditionally as that's a divider, that's a barrier, that's something that cuts neighborhoods in half. And so there were some people who said, oh, this cuts us off from the waterfront, we should get rid of it, it's not attractive. But then on the other hand, this is an area where a lot of artists and art gallery dealers had already started to come. And they had come to this neighborhood specifically for the industrial warehouses, these great open floor plates that were in the industrial warehouses, and with a great deal of appreciation for industrial forms. And they immediately got it. They were like, they were our first supporters, the artists and the art dealers. And they signed on immediately. And then very quickly, there were a lot of people who'd spent time in this neighborhood looking and had noticed it and had appreciation for it, and there just wasn't something to rally around. And when we started Friends of the High Line, it gave them a common point to rally around, and we grew our support base very quickly after we started.
So when I'm looking down underneath the High Line right now, you can see that there's some walkway where we are, but then it dead ends right into a building. Are there businesses under the High Line all the way down?
Yeah, so when we first started, there was a business under here. There was an old warehouse that was actually built underneath it. So the railroad, from a real estate standpoint, is just an easement. So the railroad, CSX, that owned it, just owned the steel structure and a 30-foot easement above it. So 22 different property owners own property below it. And, you know, that's the biggest opposition. There were people in the community that didn't like it, but the people that really wanted it torn down were the people, these property owners, because they own property underneath it and, you know, they couldn't build up. And they own the air rights under it and above it, but they would have to build around it. So it was very impractical for them to develop. So they were the ones that were advocating to tear it down a decade before we came along. They've been trying to tear it down since the late 80s.
So you can see that this is a warehouse in front of us, and the trucks are backed up to the warehouses. So if this High Line wasn't here, this particular warehouse or business could, in theory, build straight
right.
up.
Yeah, right. So that's why they wanted to tear down, is to be able to develop their property. And you
it's
know,
kind of sitting on a gold mine in New York right now.
Yeah. I mean, what the irony is it's actually been even more beneficial for the High Line, because it's created such an amenity that it's been a boom for real estate all near the High Line. We can go into sort of how the zoning happened, but
well, yeah, let's go upstairs and take a look. So
we're going up the what we call the Ganzevoort Stair, because it comes down at Ganzevoort Street, or comes up from Ganzevoort Street. And it's a very simple stair, but a lot of thought went into the way that it was designed. First of all, this is one of the opportunities that we have to really stretch out the stairs and make what the design team likes to call a slow stair. So there's a rise and then a long landing and then a rise and then another long landing. And it also allows us, whenever we can, we like to take the stairs up through the body of the structure. So you have this experience as you're going up from the street. You're on this level that you can see now with all of the activity of the street and the sidewalk. You come up, you're in this transitional zone where you're in the belly of the High Line, really, with these massive steel girders on both sides of you with all of the rivets that you can reach out and touch. and then you pass through and you're into this green landscape up above. So whenever we have the opportunity to take the stairs up through the body of the structure this way, we try and do it. Sometimes the way that the land sites and what we can get access to doesn't allow it, and then we do different things.
So you wanted to see this landing.
Yeah, and one of the advantages of the slow stairs, one is it slows you down. You know, streets are fast, and the High Line was slow. That was one of the design team's motto, was keep it slow. But the other thing it does is, the High Line's about 3 stories off the ground. So when you walk 3 stories up, you're a little winded. But when you walk on these slow stairs, you don't even really notice the incline. And so it's a much more sort of generous, easy way to come up. And one of my favorite things is when you're on the stairs, you can look and you can see the I-beams that were cut, you know, to have to make this possible.
Oh, right.
And, you know, when we first started the design process, we had a structural engineer look at the High Line, because a lot of people said, oh, it's been unused for a long time, is it, you know, gonna, and that was one of the things opponents always said, is this thing's gonna fall down, it's a danger, it's gonna kill somebody. And the engineer said, this structure is so overbuilt, because it was meant to haul moving loaded freight cars and all the vibrations they carry, that it's so overbuilt. They said you could remove almost a third of the structure and it would still stand. Here we only just removed, you know, 2 I-beams. But it gives you sort of a hint of how structurally strong, like when you're standing on the street and you look up, you know, you can count almost a dozen beams. Whereas if you look up at a highway, you know, overpass, you'll see 3, 4. It just gives you an indication of how sturdy this was built. One, meant to last hundreds of years, but also, you know, its original use was these moving freight cars. Not as a park.
You can see also just the grass is already pushing through the glass barriers here, and they're hanging, there are plants hanging off the edge as we go by. The idea that nature is, again, taking over this massive structure was something that was very important in the design. It reflects back to the time when nature, in fact, did colonize the structure when nobody was up here, and we wanted a park environment that reflected that power. So you're getting the sense of, you can see all of these vines are beginning to pour down over the sides of the railings. It's really beautiful from the street level.
This is stunning. This is absolutely beautiful. I mean, you have trees growing up here. I mean, this is incredible.
So one of the difficulties of working up here was there was so little depth. There's about 13 inches in most places of soil. So to create this woodland, this Ganzevoort woodland right here at the beginning, they bermed up. So they created these Corten steel barriers to create a little more depth to be able to plant these trees. And as we're walking along, it's going to get a little lower because there's so, you know, little soil depth of the structure.
Now there's a plaque.
There's one plaque right here. You'll see a number of different plaques as you go along. As Robert was saying a little bit earlier, we have a signage plan for the High Line that's very conservative. We don't want a lot of big signs up here that pull your attention away from the environment that you're in. It's a small environment, and we want it to speak for itself. That said, there are a bunch of different needs that you have with signage. There's directional signage, which you can see on the railings there. There's signage to explain some of the public art programs. You can see one of those over here. And the sign we're standing at here, it says Ganzevoort Woodland, and it tells one of the donors that helped us do this, Donald Pels and Wendy Keyes. So you'll see, as we go along, different donors acknowledge from their support. Don and Wendy are really very, very special to us because they are actually our very first major supporters who came to us in 2000 and have been with us ever since. They're part of the group of people who really rallied around us and made everything that we're doing here possible. Another thing that's worth pointing out that is both the past and the future in one place. This is really the last hub of meatpacking that exists in the meatpacking district. It's called the co-op, the meat co-op. It's a group of meatpackers that collectively rent this one piece of land from the city. So this is really the only meatpacking that's left in the meatpacking district. And directly adjacent to it is the site of the future Whitney Museum of American Art, which has been designed by Renzo Piano and will rise at that location right there on the site of a former meatpacking plant. So it's very exciting for us, the idea that at the southern end of the high High Line, there'll be a cultural institution of that significance that's anchoring the southern end. It's going to really add so much to this neighborhood and also to the experience of coming to the High Line.
Can we, I mean, you guys come up here all the time, so you guys walk up the stairs and stand here and can talk about all that. But for me, just, you know, coming up here from seeing that steel structure and walking up here and seeing a park. I mean, we're literally in the sky. It's a park in the sky with this incredible view of New York. We're higher than so much other... You never see New York this way before. How did you go from seeing this steel structure to seeing this?
Well, that's why we didn't... This wasn't in some ways our idea. This is what nature did. You know, that's what... When you look at these great photos of what it looked like in the 90s, nature had reclaimed this. I mean, it was full of wildflower. There were little clumps of trees and plants growing over it. It had really taken it back. So, you know, ironically, when we were first starting out, we weren't sure we wanted a park up here. I think if you had asked us in that first year, we were open to putting trains back up here, maybe building structures. And it was really over time, the more time we spent up here, and once the public saw the photos of what people say, we wanted to look like that. So it was trying to sort of recapture that feeling that was up here, but yet make it open to the public.
I think when you looked at it from the street at that time, one of the things that's tricky about the High Line when viewed from the street is you often can't see that much of it. You can see just a little bit, and then it disappears behind a building or goes through a building. And so it was easy to think it was just a bunch of small pieces of some old relic. And I think for both of us, learning that it was unbroken, that it went all the way from where we're standing at Ganzevoort Street up to 34th Street, that it allowed you to move through the city across 22 different blocks at this very unusual level, which is about three stories high. So you think of being a park in the sky, you think, oh, it's like the Empire State Building. But it's not. We're only three stories up, which allows you the sense of elevation and the views, but also the ability to you can hold a conversation with somebody who's down on the street. If you raise your voice a little bit, you can recognize your friend down there and wave to them. So you're removed, but you're still connected. And the history of the way the High Line was built, because it was built at a time when elevated structures were being torn down because they shaded the avenues, it was all built inboard from the main north-south avenue. So we're going through city blocks, so it's this very unusual view where you're sort of in the interior of blocks. So you're seeing things from a perspective that you would never otherwise see them. And so we were really had great fortune that this all of the unusual aspects of this site were here and just waiting to be taken advantage of. It was this amazing opportunity that was just sitting there, and unlike anything else in the world.
Well, let's start walking. So tell me about the first time that you guys, did you guys come up here together for the first time?
Yep.
What was that like? How did you get up here and why did you even come up here? I mean, how did you even know that you wanted to see?
Well, we did. You know, a lot of people have exciting stories of having trespassed up here in the good old days, and come to great parties that used to be held up here, and had romantic interludes up here that they all trespassed up to do. By the time we understood that we wanted to come up here, we had already formed the group Friends of the High Line, and so we had to be good and law-abiding and do it through a tour with the railroad representatives of the railroad.
But until then, neither of you had ever seen it before.
No, I think that's one of the interesting...
You had only seen it from underneath.
Yeah, that's one of the sort of odd and interesting things about how this all happened, that we became interested in the High Line, looking at it from the street, what you thought was its least flattering angle, but that was the angle that seduced us. And the idea that there was something up there and it must be great was what really captivated us and brought us out to this community board meeting in the summer of 1999, which is where we met. We met at a meeting of Manhattan Community Board number 4. And the community board is the branch of New York City government that allows general members of the public to genuinely participate in the decision-making process of things that go on in New York City. And the High Line was on the agenda because CSX had recently bought it. And they had commissioned a study about possible reuse alternatives, and so they were presenting that study. And we went to that meeting and happened to sit next to each other. And we were the only people in the room who really wanted to save the High Line. And so we exchanged business cards and got together a little bit after that. And that was basically the beginning of Friends of the High Line. But we'd never been up here. We'd never seen it. It was just really in our minds. We just thought, God, it must be amazing up there to move through the city at that level for 22 blocks, all the way from Gansevoort to 34th Street. What an incredible opportunity.
Well, let me ask you guys about this fantastic structure above us. This is the, what is this?
We're standing underneath the Standard Hotel, which opened about almost exactly the same time as the High Line opened in 2009. And it's probably one of the last buildings in this part of the High Line that'll actually be built over the High Line. But it reflects back to the historic relationship of buildings to the High Line. The High Line was, when it was originally conceived in the late 1920s, it was conceived as a rail line that would pull up next to buildings, connect to them with sidings, go through buildings to really improve the efficiency of the movement of goods from the railroad into factories and warehouses.
Without running people over.
So that was refrigerated warehouses that the train went through. If you look in this direction over here, that was a meatpacking plant that the trains went through. It's later been added to. So this is a modern interpretation of the way that buildings used to relate to the High Line. And it's an incredible building.
And it's famous for a few things. One, Andre Balazs owns it, and he's, you know, just sort of a big guy in the city, and it's very fashionable. There's a room on the top that has some of the best, sort of like a modern version of the Rainbow Room in Rockefeller Center, you know, sort of a downtown version. But I think what it's also well known for is when it opened, there were a lot of stories about people watching people having sex in the windows from the High Line. And that brought a lot of people in and you can still see sometimes people will just stop right over there and just stare up. It's a little less exciting in the reality. I mean, I've come up here a lot and I always look. But, you know, you don't see things that often. So it's a little bit, I think people that stay there now know that, you know, you close your curtains. But it gives it a little, you know, and it's interesting because one of the things about the High Line, it's a different way of seeing into the city. And the design team used to talk about part of it, you know, voyeurism was one of the words they used. I don't think they intended it quite like that. I think they were more, it's voyeuristic in seeing the city, into people's bedrooms, but, you know, it has a...
But there are, it's a landscape. You can see it's a landscape, but part of what's interesting about the landscape is this unusual way of interacting with buildings and this inside out. I mean, we're about to go through what we call the 14th Street Passage, which is where trains went through this old meatpacking plant. Some of them went straight through. Some of them stopped at the side and loaded and unloaded meats. It's very unusual to have a lush green landscape that is actually a New York City public park go through the center of a private building. And where it goes through the center of a private building, that space is now in public control. So you have the world of the public going through the world of the private world and just cutting a hole right through the center of it.
Right through the middle of it. So right now we're about to walk in under the underbelly of a giant building.
Right.
And the park is just continuing its path through.
And you're in a building, but it's a park.
We're in a building, but we're in a park.
Right.
What's fascinating about it, too, is that it's really only about... It's probably a four car lane highway.
Four tracks.
Yeah, and it's different at different widths. So this is at one of its widest. So here you could have there are actually four tracks because it would load and unload in this building. So this building that we're walking through, you can see there used to be sidings here, and there were meat hooks right. Oh, we can see them right here. You can see the meat hooks right over there. So the train cars would, and that's why they had the extra width here, is they would come out on a siding and load and unload the meat carcasses onto this building. It would go into this meatpacking plant, be cut up, and then taken all over New York.
What made you want to leave that stuff here? Some people might come in and say, I don't want to see old meat hooks.
Yeah, it's one of the interesting cases, and I think a lot of people are always asking us, why doesn't this building look like this? We don't have control over it. We have control over what happens on the High Line. But that's a different building. That's a private property owner. So eventually, actually, sadly, that'll probably get torn down and we'll lose the meat hooks. But we don't have control over what people do next to it. And that's where, again, as Jess was talking about, you know, you have this inner relationship you normally don't have between other buildings and a park.
Like right here, that's on the other side of this wooden wall here. That's private. That's under private control on the other side. So we want to ultimately work with this building owner to figure out a way where those two spaces can work well together and serve the public well on the High Line. But it's a whole process that has to be gone through, and it's one of the things that makes working on this project so complicated but also so interesting, as you end up in all of these unusual relationships with all these different people.
And we're coming up on an elevator. So everywhere you can walk on the High Line, you can go in a wheelchair. So it's all wheelchair accessible. So we have elevators in four locations. We call this the Founders Wall, where we recognize all the elected officials that helped make this happen, our board and a lot of our main donors, and tell a tiny summary of the story. Again, when we opened, we had no signage, and one of the things people wanted was a place to at least know what the history of this was and sort of how it came to be. So we put this up just a few months ago.
Okay, so I want you to read me the third plaque down, starting with in 1999.
In 1999, with the High Line threatened with demolition, neighborhood residents Joshua David and Robert Hammond formed Friends of the High Line to advocate for the preservation and reuse of the structure. In 2002, through the leadership of Mayor Michael Bloomberg and New York City Council, the City of New York boldly committed to transform the High Line into a one-of-kind park. Innovative design was central to the vision. The goal was to create a public landscape as unusual and unexpected as the High Line itself.
So there you have the whole story. You don't really need to.
And our name's over there, too.
So, you know, people might read that and think, you know, this Joshua Dave and Robert Hammond, they're just two, like, rich guys, who just really powerful guys who came in and threw a bunch of money down and created the High Line. It's not really what happened.
No.
And a lot of people also say, oh, you guys should have bought all this real estate around the High Line, and then you'd be really, really rich now, and we didn't do that either, unfortunately.
And I'm still in a rental apartment, a market-rate rental apartment that goes up every year. So I really, that's how you know we weren't smart. If we were these really smart real estate guys, I would have at least bought one apartment, much less, you know, a whole building.
But that's not what happened. What actually happened?
Well, we met at this community board meeting. You know, neither one of us had ever been to a community board meeting. It was August of 99, and I think both of us were hoping someone else could take this on and we could help out. I remember saying, you know, why don't you do it? And he said, well, why don't you do it? And so we exchanged business cards, and it grew from there. And you know, I think even in the first, for that first year, I think a lot of the time we were hoping some other organization would come along and sort of take it and make it happen, because we didn't have, you know, the expertise. We both had full-time jobs and careers that had nothing to do with this.
You were a writer. You were a writer. And what did you do?
I was based working on small startups, entrepreneurial internet startups.
Mm-hmm. And so you guys said in 1999, we'll just plug away at this?
It seemed, you know, it was just such an incredible opportunity when you looked at it, when you said, and nobody was doing anything to save it at that point. There had been a Save the High Line movement before us by a guy named Peter Oblitz, but he had passed away and the movement had died with him. And so nobody was working on it. I came to that meeting thinking, oh, we'll find some historic preservation group that's all interested in this, and we'll just lick a few envelopes and give them $20 and, you know, feel good about it. But those groups didn't exist. And
actually, a lot of people at that meeting were against preserving the High Line.
Most people were either didn't care at all or were vehemently for tearing it down.
But how did you guys find each other in that crowd?
We just happened to sit next to each other.
So what happened then? So you realize in that next year or two that nobody was jumping in. There was no preservation.
We realized pretty quickly. We were just hoping someone would take it on. But, you know, we kept going through the steps of creating an organization, sort of, you know, realizing maybe no one's going to take it on. So what could we do to get it going? And I think we also, I mean, I, I'm definitely a dreamer, but also a realist. So we knew that the chances of this actually happening were very little. My mom asked me when I first told her about it, she goes, well, what's the chances of it happening? I said, oh, you know, like 1 in 100. So I think,
what
you know,
did
we
she
were.
Say?
She was like, oh, that's nice.
I said, it was such a long shot at the start that the way that I looked at it in the beginning was just because there was nobody talking about saving it. I thought my goal really wasn't to save it. My goal was just to have a greater discussion about the possibilities. What could you do with this? Nobody was saying, what could you do with this? They were only saying, tear it down. So I think if I'd gone into it at that point thinking my goal is to save this thing, I probably would have walked away from it. But I had a much more modest goal at the beginning, which was just like, let's look at this a little bit more closely before you tear it down, because once it's gone, it's gone. And it's a really big and unusual thing. I have to go back because I was sheepish about something and didn't. You asked how did you meet? How did you connect? So I talk about it a little bit in the book. I'm gay. Robert's gay. We were at a community board meeting. Community board meetings are not necessarily filled with a lot of hot gay guys. In fact, they're not filled with a lot of hot gay guys. And I thought Robert was cute. And so in that room of people, I thought, well, I'll sit next to the cute guy.
And I think that was the last time he ever thought I was cute.
But, you know, it's funny. People think that we were boyfriends or that we are boyfriends, and we're not. But the fact that we are both gay, I think, there's something important about the High Line that comes from that. There's something about the constituency that gathered around us that comes from that. A lot of our early supporters were from our personal circle of friends, which helped us reaching out into various circles in New York where traditionally gay people have a greater reach in design and fashion and art.
And I think element of organizing and an element of getting involved, maybe.
Us gays are so organized.
we
love to have parties, too. Gays love to have parties, so we had a lot of them.
A straight friend came to one of our events, and he was like, wow, there's a lot of men here. And he didn't get that it was, like, all gay men. And that, you know, he was, like, the straight guy. But
So did you guys become best friends? Let's keep walking.
Yeah.
Did you guys become best friends through this whole process?
Well, I think that's one of the interesting things about it is that, I mean, I think Josh and I are definitely friends, but we're partners mm-hmm. in this. But, you know, and that's, we weren't good friends before, and we, you know, I think care deeply about each other. But I think a lot of people assume we're best friends. And, you know, it's not the case, and I think in a lot of ways, it's helped us. I mean, Josh, on one hand, is my longest partnership that I've had. He's had how long is your?
28 years. My boyfriend and I have been together 28 years. But now they're sort of, I call Stephen Robert and Robert Stephen, and that annoys both of them. So.
Sure.
It doesn't annoy me. I sort of like it. So my relationships aren't quite that long. But, I mean, it's one of the ways that we've been able to make this partnership work. It's one of the things that...
Upper way, I think. I have to stop for a second because we're crossing... There are a bunch of things that are happening here that are sort of important. We're crossing 14th Street, which is technically the line of leaving the Meatpacking District behind and entering Chelsea. So we're sort of going from one neighborhood to another. We're standing on a part of the High Line that's called the Diller von Furstenberg Sun Deck. And it's special for a number of different reasons. It has this great view out to the Hudson River. Whenever we did press events with the mayor or anything like that, we would always choose to do them here. It has this unusual thing that it's as wide as the High Line ever gets, and it splits into two levels. So there's an upper level and a lower level. Sometimes buildings were built around it, knowing that it was coming. So as the building that we're coming up to was a Nabisco factory. And you can see the line over here. This very western end of it was actually torn down and rebuilt to go around the High Line. You can see you'll see a difference in architectural style just to the right over there. That's the older part. This was built to go around the High Line and met the High Line at its level. But in other circumstances, the High Line would adjust to meet existing buildings. So on the other side of the street, you have, on the other side of 10th Avenue, you have another Nabisco factory. Where the High Line went down to meet that existing level at its that existing building at it, its level, and then beyond that was a refrigerated warehouse. We're coming up on also another great feature of the High Line, a water feature on the sun deck, where the water is just skimming over the surface of the walkway, and you can take off your shoes like those guys over there and those kids further on, and just walk around in it. It's really, really lovely, and the sound of it is really, really nice.
One of the biggest compliments I heard about this was, they said, did you do this on purpose, or was there a water leak? And then, because it looks like, you know, it almost looks like a condition that could just happen up here, but it's also funny, I mean, most people assume that everyone's looking out towards the Hudson River here. You get this great view and sunset. But when I walk up here, I see just as many people looking this way and looking, you know, at the bodies and the people on these lounge chairs. You can also see that the sun deck chairs are laid along the tracks. And as we've been walking along, you know, sometimes you notice the old rail tracks, you know, sticking out from the plantings. And you'll notice these yellow numbers written on them. And those are GPS coordinates. Because when we did construction, we had to remove everything that was here, including the rails. But we tagged everything. And so we put them back. So this piece of rail was originally in this exact position and went back exactly where it was, you know, before construction.
Now, why did you have to do that?
Oh, we didn't have to. You know, it was part of, as we were talking about, we didn't want a lot of signage. But this is one of the clues to people that it was a railroad. You know, without the tracks, you know, it gives you these little hints of what the High Line, you know, here's a little girl that's come up in her bathing suit, you know, to walk in the...
It's so cute. It makes me want to put my feet in it. So did you have to, as part of the, describe for me sort of that final legal push, the big win that you guys got that allowed you to create this park.
Yeah, I don't, you know, there wasn't one moment where it happened. It was so complex. I mean, I don't think until we really opened did I really think it was going to happen. But I think the biggest probably legal piece was when the city came on board. Mayor Bloomberg reversed Mayor Giuliani's position of wanting to demolish the High Line. You know, Giuliani really wanted to demolish the High Line. One of his last acts in office, and right 2 days before he left office, was signing the demolition order. So when the Bloomberg administration reversed that decision, you know, that was probably one of the biggest pieces.
One of the things that's interesting about the book is it takes you through all of those different stages and so many different battles or projects that we had to do to get from one stage to another, like what Robert was just describing, that also involved a lawsuit where we actually had to sue the city of New York. We sued the city of New York under the Giuliani administration because it was going to tear the High Line down. And then we, when Mayor Bloomberg came into office, we did a whole presentation to his administration about the values of the High Line, and specifically commissioned an economic feasibility study to show how the High Line would actually generate funds for the city through increasing property values around it. So all of these things were very incremental. It was step after step after step, and each time that you won something or you got a victory, there was still another thing after it that you had to do. So it was very, it was a very complex process.
So tell me where we are right now. What is this?
So we're in an area that we call the Chelsea Market Passage, because this large building that we're going through is called the Chelsea Market Building. It's an old Nabisco factory. The trains used to come through this passage. They used to unload into platforms that are behind that wall.
What about these beautiful colored glass windows?
So we're looking at a public artwork called The River That Flows Both Ways by an artist named Spencer Finch. And commissioned this with Creative Time right for the opening of the High Line, and it was funded by the Rockefeller Foundation. And it's a project, he went out on, you can see the Hudson River from both sides of the Chelsea Market Passage. You can see it there and on the other side. And it's a piece that really refers to the river that flows both ways, because the Hudson is a tidal river, so it goes in both directions. And the trains running alongside it go in both directions. And so he went out onto a boat and photographed over 700 photographs of the way that light reflects off the Hudson River. and translated each of those photographs into a different panel of glass, and those were installed in these historic casement windows in this passage. And so that's it's just a beautiful, beautiful piece. And just the way the changing light flows through it is really amazing.
We're standing over what's called the Northern Spur. And this is one of the spurs that used to go into this warehouse. This was an old refrigerated warehouse. There used to be no windows on it. And you can see where the trains, where those bricks are, used to run into those... into that building.
Also, this is a great place to see this wonderful Art Deco decorative railing. There are two different kinds of railing on the High Line. Places where they thought it would be visible from the street, they did this much heavier, ornamented railing with these rectangular and diamond-shaped shields covered with all these rivets. That's where you see, what you see of the High Line at street crossings. And then these other places, like over here, we have this pipe railing that's much simpler. Any place where they thought you weren't going to see it, they use that much simpler pipe railing. So these are all the original historic railings of the High Line that we've adapted just very, very delicately to meet public safety requirements. But this pattern is a real icon of the High Line.
Because that's beautiful. I mean, that's incredible looking. It looks like art in and of itself. Do you have to get donations every year just to keep the park up?
Yeah, it costs us about $3 million a year to do all of the maintenance, the art, the programs, and we have to raise all that from scratch every year.
Every year.
Yeah, but, you know, people have really embraced it. You know, we have thousands of members, of people that give $40, $75 and more, you know, to help make it happen. So when you... I'm going to wash my hands, too. When you press the water fountain button, this artist piece comes. Her name's Julia Schwartz, and it's...
Hi. I can give you my complete assurance that you are safe here.
You are safe here.
Everything is running smooth. However, life is filled with...
So it's these words of comfort and support and love, but said by a computer-generated voice. So to sort of make you feel a little bit uneasy. And when you go in the elevator, it's different songs, but just read by a computer. So it's a Led Zeppelin lyrics, but it's read by a computer. So you're sort of listening, and you're like, what?
So the water fountain isn't the piece. It's the
sound. And when you go in the bathrooms and turn on the faucet, sounds start coming out from the drain. And again, so all these pieces are meant to be temporary, and it's a way you can get away with things that people might not want permanently, but you can do, you know, for a year, and some of them, we're coming up on one of my favorite pieces we've done, and it's just going to be up for a month.
How are you guys, if something happened to you guys, or if you guys decide you need to take that job in London or something, what would happen to the Conservancy?
Well, the High Line would go on, but, you know, the good news is the High Line is not dependent on us. I think that's always been one of my goals, is that it's, one, a park that's well-loved by New Yorkers, but two, that is not dependent on us or, you know, our personalities. And, you know, there's a whole organization and a board that would and will eventually, you know, go on without us. This is one of my favorite features, and this was something that almost didn't happen. So we're standing right over 10th Avenue at 17th Street, and it's this spot where the High Line crosses 10th Avenue. And to structurally cross this span, they built the structure in the shape of a square. So we call it the 10th Avenue Square. And it has this unique condition where you're standing over 10th Avenue. So the designers had this thought of, what about since the structure is so overbuilt, what about removing some of the I-beams and creating this amphitheater that goes down right over 10th Avenue? And they removed these giant steel plates that were there and put glass in there. So you can sit and stand and look, and you're right over the avenue. And so, you know, as you can see it right now, the taxis and cars are sort of popping out below you. It almost feels like you're in a video game. But it's this experience that you really have in very few places where you're over an avenue, you know, looking up at Manhattan. And then it also creates this amphitheater. We do a lot of performances in here. We do... music performances, we do kids readings here, and as I was saying, you know, everywhere you can walk, we want you to be able to go on a in a wheelchair. So when they originally designed this, they had steps. So the designers had to go back and make it wheelchair accessible. So they built this ramp that's also become one of the people's favorite play features, probably after the water feature, is you'll be here and you'll have kids just running up and down. And, you know, this is an example where private donors came in. We didn't have money to build this. And two donors, the Hellers and Novogratz, has stepped in to actually make this possible. And it happened, you know, literally weeks before we were starting construction. And if you look to the south, most people don't even notice this, but you can see the Empire State Building. I mean, the Statue of Liberty. So here, standing looking south, you know, there's the Statue of Liberty. You know, and it's just some of these unexpected vistas. You know, you're sitting in the middle of Manhattan. You look south, and there's the Empire State Building. You can see where the High Line used to, you know, crosses over 10th Avenue and those two spurs. And then this grove of trees. As I was saying, you know, the High Line only has a few inches of soil. So the way that the designers figured out how to put trees here is they actually put planters in between the I-beams. So these planters are dropped down. There's like basically a steel container, and then a planter dropped down. So the roots are basically growing in, you know, the I-beams of this structure.
So these are kind of newer trees. They're a few years old, it looks like. How big do you think that they'll grow?
They'll grow a fair amount bigger. You know, these are only two. I mean, they're older than, they were only planted 2 years ago.
Wow. So you're going to have a little forest on the High Line.
Yeah, and you can see it from the street. So when you're driving up 10th Avenue, you know, you see this steel structure with a canopy of trees above it.
The other thing that's amazing about this 10th Avenue Square feature, and it's in a lot of the features that we do in the High Line, it really takes advantage of the relationship between this upper level and the street and the visual interconnection between them. That it turns the life of the street really sort of into theater that you watch. The very mundane aspects of New York City life become theatrical. Like this whole time we've been talking, there have been those two people down there trying to get a cab that have been down there this whole time we've been talking. They don't know that this is the hour in New York you can't get a cab. So I'm guessing they're from out of town because they would have given up by now. If they just got one. But it's also the opposite direction when you're standing on the street and you look up at this. This is the people who are in this feature. They're like in a terrarium. It's theatrical in the opposite direction as well.
So this is one of the other art pieces that's one of my favorite that we've done. And one of the developers along the High Line has given us this billboard every other month for 3 months. And Joel Sternfeld has curated different pieces that are going up there. The first one was one of Joel's iconic High Line landscapes. But this was Joel's actually favorite photograph ever taken. It's by Robert Adams. And it's of this country path. And when he first showed it to me, I was like, this is the most boring photo. You know, it's a black and white square photo of an old road with some leaves and trees. I mean, it's probably what people thought of the High Line when he showed him the High Line. But it was so quiet. You know, I was thinking, let's get something loud and impactful. But what I love about it is, you know, so there's this road going off into the horizon. And when you're standing here, you have 10th Avenue going off into the horizon. And then you have the High Line, and it's right in the middle.
It's kind of perfect.
It's just perfect. And it has this sort of quiet beauty. And that I think most people don't even notice it. But, you know, then you also look at it, and it could never be mistaken for advertising. Because sometimes photos, it's hard to tell the difference between art and photos. And when we show you the photo right now, it's hiding the billboard behind it. But the billboard behind it is for Larry Flint's strip club. And it looks like that almost looks like more of an art piece than something, you know, than a lot of billboards. But that's why I sort of love it is a lot of the art, you don't even have to know that it exists, and people, it sort of makes people sort of stop and question and look at it. And then always, you know, because it's about looking around, you know, like that advertisement is almost just as popular. It's a big ad for mini storage. It says, if you don't like gay marriage, don't get gay married. And they were giving free mini storage if you had a gay marriage license. So, you know, it's just about everything that happens around the High Line. That, and that's the beauty, that we don't control all of it. Because some people said, oh, why don't you get control of all the billboards and do art on all the billboards? One, most developers are not going to give us their billboards because they make a lot of money on them. But two, that's the beauty is, you know, you get things that people like and don't like. A lot of people have been complaining about the Larry Flint billboard. You know, call us, why can't you get rid of it? One, we don't have control over it. And two, to me, that's, and you know, people said, oh, it's tough to have that juxtaposition, this beautiful art piece. But to me, that's part of what the High Line's about, is this, you know, there was the original juxtaposition of the steel structure and the green landscape, and now it's about, you know, high art and low advertising, and, you know, that's part of the spirit of the city in New York.
I want to tell you a little bit about where we're standing, because it's actually a sort of a significant place for a number of reasons. One, this is when Robert and I first came up here the first time, we came up through Chelsea Market. You used to be able to access the High Line through an old freight elevator in Chelsea Market. You can't anymore. But we stepped out there in the Chelsea Market passage, came across the 10th Avenue Square. It didn't have that feature. It was all flat and tracks and big puddles and so forth. And then crossed over, we've crossed over 10th Avenue and we're leading into the Chelsea section. And I think this was really, this run that we're about to walk into now was really our first view of the High Line and what it could offer. And as we round this corner a little bit further, what will open up is this 13 block long straightaway, which is one of the great linear open spaces of the High Line and one of the great linear open spaces of New York City. And seeing that incredible expanse of untouched, uninhabited space in the middle of Manhattan was just a really, really magical experience. And I think one of the moments where both Robert and I were like, my God, we've got to do this. If it was just sort of a maybe something of a bit of a whim to begin with, when you see something like that, it was just so moving and so impressive and really conveyed what this place could really be that I think it really sort of sealed the deal for us in wanting to commit ourselves to it.
So you came up and you saw this area right here. You stood right here.
From the Chelsea Market building.
And you stood right, you walked this path that we're walking right now.
Yes.
What did you see?
Well, there were tracks here that came across, and all of these wildflowers growing up in between them, grasses, things that had grown from seeds that birds had dropped here or had fallen off the trains or had just drifted through the air, whatever could subsist in what was really just basically gravel. There wasn't any soil really here. There were just seeds that were tough enough to grow in gravel, and they would grow up and die and over the years create enough organic matter that more things could grow here. And it was what the kind of landscape that some people would say, there's a name for it in horticulture, but I'm blanking on
it.
An opportunistic. It takes a site that has been cleared for one reason or another. Sites that have been cleared for one reason or another, and then whatever is strong enough to survive in it takes it over. It was one of those landscapes. But so sort of ragtag in a way, but really incredibly beautiful in another way. And it just stretched out as far as you could see, and the Empire State Building's about to pop out into view here, and you're walking in this, what was a completely hidden space from the street, and one that's really just a few feet from my front door. I'd lived in this neighborhood for 15 years and had no idea that this was up here.
Only
seen it from underneath. And the idea that there was this vast open space right down the street from where I'd lived for 15 years that I'd never seen, that none of my neighbors knew, that nobody knew it was here, was just like discovering this amazing hidden treasure. It was a fantastic feeling.
And when you saw it wild for the first time, is that when you decided that you wanted it to be a park that captured that wild feeling?
why are you laughing at that? The whole evolution of what we thought it could be at that time and what it ultimately became is a really fascinating story. And it involved so many different things. It involved learning about what you were allowed to do up here, What were the regulatory things about making opening this to the public? We're part of a program called Rails to Trails, which takes unused rail corridors and banks them. It's called rail banking. It banks unused rail corridors and keeps them for future transportation use by using them as parks. So there are regulatory things that go along with that. And then beginning to do the whole design process with our design team, James Corner Field Operations, Diller Scofidio and Renfro, and the horticulturist Pete Udolf. All of these things over time led to this vision and the
Yeah, but what was the moment that you knew that you didn't want this to be buildings on top of a railroad tracks or a metro rail
right.
line? When
right.
did you know that you wanted it?
I think that first walk really was that time where you. I think it firmed in my mind something that I thought was the initial attraction of the High Line of was just basically, wouldn't it be cool to be able to be up here instead of down there and walk through the city the way that we're walking through it right now in this very unusual perspective, three stories up, a little bit in from the avenue. We're in the Chelsea section now, so the High Line's almost always set back about 100 feet from the avenue with buildings between us and the avenue. This very, very unusual perspective on the interior of city blocks. And wouldn't it be cool to just be able to move through the city in that very unusual way? What it looked like, I think, took that wasn't really in my head. I don't think it was really in Robert's head what it would ultimately look like. But that was the moment, I would say.
I just want to just point out something, because one of the things that's interesting about the High Line is the architecture, not just the architecture on the High Line, but the architecture around the High Line. So the High Line runs through five historic districts that you know we'll walk through on this walk. But then it's also home to some of the most interesting new architecture in New York. And so the spot where we're standing on 19th Street, you can see a building by Frank Gehry, Jean Nouvel, Shigeru Ban, Annabelle Seldorf, Neil Denari. And so, you know, it's this place where taking a walk on the High Line, you see sort of some of the most interesting old and, you know, new architecture on the High Line. And what's great is it's inspired a lot of the developers around here to invest in, you know, interesting architecture.
That was one of the criticisms that you guys faced in your book. You talk about this idea that some people thought, oh, this is going to be another she, highly designed kind of thing. And you had to... sounds like you guys had to kind of fight against that idea.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's most important is this is free. You know, the High Line, there was so much, hyper design spaces that were happening in sort of, in the 2000, the late 2000, whatever that, you know, I don't know what those time periods are. Last decade. But, you know, so much of it was private. You know, it was office buildings, people's homes, museums. You know, people where you have places where you at least have to pay an admission. And this is all, you know, free and open to the public. Plus, there's a lot of diversity in this neighborhood. We just walked by one of a public housing project right here. We're going to walk past another one. So, you know, almost 90% of the kids in this neighborhood are on a lunch program. So it's actually a neighborhood that's very diverse in a lot of ways, including economically. You know, yes, a lot of the new buildings are, you know, some of these fancy condos. But one of the parts of the rezoning that helped build the High Line is the city council, Christine Quinn, really fought to make sure that 30% of the new development in the neighborhood would be affordable housing.
Keep walking.
So one of the things we've really transitioned from the Meatpacking District, we've crossed 10th Avenue, we've gone through Chelsea Market, and now we're firmly in Chelsea, in really going through the heart of what's known as the West Chelsea Art Gallery area. And the High Line changes in this area in that it gets narrower. We're in for the next 13 blocks, it's almost always the width of just two train tracks wide. It's straight instead of zigzagging and doing all sorts of other things. And we're set back from the street and really on the inside of city blocks. So I think you'll notice it's much quieter here. The wind isn't blowing the way that it was just a block or so back from here. And it'll continue that way all the way up to 30th Street, this more interior, enclosed kind of feeling that puts you in much closer proximity to the buildings around you. So it has a very intimate feel and increases that communication through windows and back and forth between the interior of buildings and the exterior of buildings. So it's a really interesting part of the line.
I noticed that Robert always stops and smells the flowers and feels the trees. Is he the plant guy?
I was always more of a gardener before Robert. I actually gardened, and I don't think Robert ever really did. I think as we were going through the process, there are two aspects to the High Line. It is a structure. It is a piece of architecture. Part of what's compelling about it is its quality as a built structure and how it relates to other built structures. And then there was this amazing landscape that had colonized itself up on top of it. And so those are two powerful forces that were embodied in one entity. And there were, as the project went along, there were different times where you could say it should become more of an architectural project or it should become more of a landscape project. I think Robert saw it more as a landscape-based project at the beginning, and I saw it more as an architecturally-based project at the beginning. But I think what ultimately makes it the place that it is that it is both of those things seamlessly, and that'll always be its power.
And I don't know anything about plants. I don't, just because I don't, everyone asks me, oh, what's that plant? What's this? I don't know the name of any of it. But, and actually, when we were walking down on 13th Street, I saw a plant that I don't think I'd ever seen blooming before. You know, and I've probably been up here 1,000 times. And that's one of the things that's so great about the horticulture up here is that it's changing. And I want to make sure we talk about the design team because, you know, they're the ones that created this. But since we're walking up on here at 21st Street, this is another one of the public art pieces. This is by a sculptor named Sarah Z. And it's this habitat for birds.
You can see a lot of birds.
I know. I remember when she first preserved it, I said, I can guarantee you no bird is going to use these bird feeders because it's so near the path. They're never going to stand. And, you know, here I am, literally, one is 3 feet. Picking through the remnants of the bird feed. We fill these twice a day, and they're still always empty.
Oh. Yeah, look at that. That's incredible. They're not even, they don't even seem afraid of it.
Yeah, and then I was also convinced, if they come, it's going to be full of pigeons. But she did all this research about what kind of, how the feeders are configured and what pigeons, and we actually have no pigeons. So the design, you know, I think one of the success of the High Line is, you know, it's really about the design, and we were so fortunate to have the design team of James Corner Field Operations, Diller, Scafidio, and Renfro.
How did you end up picking them?
Well, originally in 2003, we did an ideas competition, because back then, no one knew what the High Line was. As Josh said, the only thing people knew about it was, oh, it's the thing that pigeons shit on you when you walk under it. And so, one, we were just trying to create awareness, and we didn't have the money or the authority to do a real competition. So we did an ideas competition in 2003. You know, one of the two of our favorites, one was a mile-long lap pool, swimming pool, and a roller coaster. You know, so you could leave the High Line as is and then have a roller coaster that would go in, it would take you up, look through people's apartments, zoom down over streets. But we had that critical progress in 2004, and we decided to do a design competition, and we had 4 finalists. But from the very beginning, I mean, when I first heard Jim Corner and Liz and Rick, I was just totally taken. I felt like they captured and got the spirit of what we were trying to create, and the difficulty of how do you preserve this magical feeling that was already up here, but yet make it open to the public, and how do you sort of create, you're not going to be able to keep it exactly as, how do you create sort of a new magic? And they also partnered with Pete Uldoff, who's a Dutch garden designer, who did all of this incredible planting, you know, that's inspired by the natural wildscape, but is yet different. You know, he's created, I mean, right now we're walking through, it's almost, you know, he created these rooms almost made of plants. And this is a much more sort of woody space where, you know, you're almost going through a tunnel of green. And in the winter, a lot of these plants have different color berries. I mean, this winter, I think I counted 3 different colors of berries, and the birds just descend on these trees in the middle of the winter. With the, you know, here are some of the remnants of these blueberries. And so, you know, one of the things that they came up with early on in their original design competition entry was the idea of these planks. And the idea was you're going to sort of, you know, reemphasize this linear nature and the idea of these concrete planks that comb into the landscape. So it's almost like the landscape is, you know, clawing back into it. And it looks very innovative, but on the other hand, they're really robust and not that, these are giant, just precast concrete planks we're standing on. You know, it looks sort of complicated and used in a different way, but it's, you know, also feels sort of very industrial. And
the benches rise up out
Yeah,
of them.
So they call them peel-up benches. So they just, it's this concrete that peels up and then these, you know, wood slats that you sit on. And
you wouldn't believe the amount of time it took to design these benches. I think we were probably in 15 different bench meetings but that only reflected a fraction of the time that the design team spent on developing different versions of it, developing all of the different options, constantly refining it. In these early stages of design for this is a completely new system. This whole walkway system with these tapered concrete planks, how you do the drainage up here so plants can grow in it, how you structure these benches, the width of the paths. We had endless discussions about how wide the path should be. All of these things, the design for this park was driven, A, by these incredible architects and landscape designers at James Corner Field Operations, Diller Scofidio and Renfro, and Pete Udolph, but it was also this just amazing collaborative process involving Friends of the High Line, the city, and the design team, and it took a long time to figure this out, to figure out how it would actually work. And that was one of the real things in the beginning. People didn't know whether it would work. We're up here now, and we've been walking through a constant flow of traffic. There are a lot of people up here today. It's a beautiful day. But we didn't know whether people would actually come. We were like, we're going to build it, and hopefully they will come. And we made a lot of decisions along the way that we hoped would inspire people to come. The visibility of the greenery from the streets to sort of lure people up because they'll see something green up there. The way the stairs were placed to be very visible. Cutouts like the 10th Avenue Square to sort of beckon to people and say, there's something up here. But we really didn't know whether anybody would come, or maybe they'd come just the first month to check it out and then, you know, that's it. So it's been incredibly gratifying to see how it's been welcomed and how people in the neighborhood have made it part of their lives. They walk to work up here, they bring their kids up here, and how visitors from other places have made it one of the things that they really want to do when they come to New York. So you have to look back this way. This is where we're at the 23rd Street lawn, where the grass starts roughly at the level of the walkway. And like the benches, the lawn peels up and lifts up off the ground over there. You'll see that a little as we go along. But what I wanted to point out here, as you can see at this bleacher seating area, which is covered with reclaimed teak. It's teak that was used in buildings that were torn down and recycled here. Behind it is the old rail platform where the trains used to pull up to this warehouse here. And you can see the old bays where the goods would go in and out there.
You said that you had some low moments in 2008 when the stock market crashed. Can you tell me about the party?
Yeah, it was a scary, you know, it was a scary time. We do every year a dinner called the Highline Chef's Dinner. It used to be Kraft Steak, now it's Colicchio and Sons, but both of them, it was Tom Colicchio's restaurant. It still is Tom Colicchio's restaurant. We're doing it this year on October 23rd. And Tom has always gathered the chefs in our neighborhood, really, that run along 10th Avenue, together to throw a dinner that benefits Friends of the High Line. And the first year we did it in 2008, it was just everybody, it was just festive and fun, and everybody was having an amazing, no, 2007 was the first year.
just festive fun. Everybody was having this amazing time. It was an incredible evening. And then the second year was the night that Lehman Brothers collapsed in 2008. We were at this Highline Chef's Dinner where all of our top supporters had come together to have this fabulous tasting menu that had been prepared by Tom Colicchio and all these other chefs. And it was just the disaster night of the American economy, and half the people had to leave early, and half the other people were left, you know, staring into their BlackBerries trying to figure out what was going on. And it was one of the, there have been many, many dramatic moments during this whole process, but that was a dramatic moment for many, many people, but one for us as well.
9/11, you know, was another example where, you know, I thought it was just over. I mean, not just, you know, the city, but selfishly, when I was standing on my roof watching the towers come down, one of my first thoughts was, well, you know, there goes the High Line too, because who's going to care about turning this elevated railroad into a park, you know, when the whole city's collapsing? But it was interesting. It galvanized people. People wanted to get behind something positive. They wanted to make a difference in the city. They wanted to get involved. And, you know, I think Josh's first reaction was, okay, no one, you know, we can't even talk to anyone about this. But people started calling us. What are we going to do? People got more excited. The reason I wanted to stop here, we're between 25th and 26th, and we're standing on the flyover, the Falcone flyover, and it's the spot. It was one of the things that the design team put in their very first design entry, and it was this idea of a walkway that takes you up off, about 8 feet up off the surface of the High Line through a canopy of trees. In this exact spot, there used to be a forest of trees growing here, because you have these two old warehouse buildings that blocked the sun and allowed enough moisture for this little forest to grow up. So their idea was this flyover. And when we first saw it, we said, oh, you know, that's nice, but it's one of the things that'll actually never get built. And they couldn't figure out how to do it in Section 1, but they were determined to do it in Section 2. So this is one of the things that also, and that's why it's named for the Falcones, this is one of the things without their gift, we could have never built this. And it creates these little vistas. You're standing here between these two warehouse buildings, and you see these old smokestacks. And it's just another reminder of, you know, that this was an industrial neighborhood. And across from it is an old warehouse that was designed by Cass Gilbert, the architect of the Woolworth building. And it was one of the first buildings that actually the High Line delivered a delivery to. And it's now being converted from a warehouse into a school.
You can hear the construction. Yeah.
So it's going to open as a new school from K through 12. I think it's 2013.
In 12, fall of 12.
So, yeah. And now we're standing over 26th Street, and the High Line should be covered in advertising. You know, there are all these billboards on the advertising, all sorts of things. And I remember it was one of the dilemmas we had when we were first starting construction. We were like, should we leave the billboards up so we can earn a little revenue from it? But then we were worried if we left them up, we'd sort of become addicted to the revenue, and we'd never take them down. And I'm so glad we did, because without them, you know, you would lose sort of these views out. But the design team sort of took the idea of one of these old billboards, but instead of advertising, it's just clear. So it's almost like a billboard frame, but instead of framing advertising, it has, when you're on the High Line, it has views out to the city. But even better is when you're on the city, it has views of people on the High Line. And, you know, it just sort of makes it almost like their art piece, you know, of the people up here, and it's illuminated at night. And to me, you know, that's, the design of the High Line is wonderful. But the reason I like, and the plants, I love how the plants are constantly changing. But the best part by far is people. You know, I mean, as we've been doing this walk, you know, you just see every kind of person. You know, it's just like a microcosm of New York, all different kinds of people. And I don't know if it's the High Line that it's slowing people down, because I think you notice people in a different way than you normally don't do, and it just causes you more sort of interactions, and you're just a little bit slower. Maybe it's the juxtaposition of the plants, but just, you know, I think one of people's favorite things about the High Line is just the people watching. And so I love this idea of just sort of its framing you know, the people on the High Line is sort of
like
a symbol
a
of that. Yep.
About halfway through your process, you got some celebrity interest involved. What was your first taste of the celebrity interest?
Well, we're actually at the site where the
Edward Butt
site. Yeah.
But it started before that.
But it was right here.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah,
it was
a little
right
further,
here.
The fence, the famed fence of the Under the Fence tour. But I think, you know, we were extraordinarily fortunate in that the very first event that we did in the winter of 2000, Kevin Bacon and Kira Sedgwick came to that, and so did Sandra Bernhard. And the Post came that night and photographed them and ran an article in the Post that day, about, the next day, about celeb push to save the High Line. And so from a very early point, there was this sense that that celebrities were part of this and were helping us. But we, you know, and then a little bit later, Edward Norton read an article in The New Yorker about the project. A lot of people started contacting us after that. And I was sitting, Robert and I still worked at home at our home offices. I'm in Chelsea, he's in the Village. And I was just sitting at my desk typing away one day, and the phone rang, and the voice on the other end said, "This is Edward Norton. I'm looking for the High Line guys." And when I heard his voice, I didn't know his work all that well. I knew some of it. And I just thought, oh, this must be Edward Norton's a pretty common name. Lots of people could be named Edward Norton. This is just some guy named Edward Norton. And then as the conversation went on and progressed, I was like, I have to ask you, but are you? And he was like, yes, I'm that one. But it was really interesting because he'd come to us with all of these impressions of his own of the High Line. He used to live in that yellow building that we said where we started the tour, where we pointed up to it and said that was an old refrigerated warehouse. He used to live in that building and sit on the roof and look down at the High Line and wonder what would become of it. And then his father also was one of the founding board members of the Rails to Trails Conservancy, which advocated for the program called Rail Banking, which is the program that we're using to walk on the High Line right now. And he also had city planning in his family. His parts of his family had done a lot of work in real estate development and in very innovative kinds of planning. And so there were a lot of different ways that he had had experience that made him naturally interested in projects like that. And I think that's where we're very fortunate with the high-profile people who've become involved with us. We did a lot of work just to haul people out to parties so that they were more glamorous and got more press. We definitely did do that. We wrangled. But for the most part, the celebrities...
Stand and face me so your
the celebrities that have been involved with us are people who've really engaged with the project and care about it deeply and come out for us time and time again and give us money, and they're part of it. It's not just famous people at a party, but they're really helping us in all of these different ways, whether it's raise funds or bring attention to the project or just, you know, guide us through difficult straits.
Yep,
Josh unlocks the gate leading into the third section of the High Line, which stretches all the way around to the west side rail yards. Josh and Robert haven't actually acquired this section yet. They're working on that. But for now, it's still what they call wild.
What we're looking at right now, this is what you first saw that day that you came up here. I mean, old rusty railroad tracks, weeds as high as your waist, and
These are going to open up in blooms
be
in about. We first came
it's
up
be
here
so
in September, and so I that's the thing I remember.
Yeah, these are, it'll
is
all
wading
turn
through,
white. It's like snow up
you know,
to your neck.
You know, right at your waist of these sort of snowy flowers and Queen's Anne lace, sort of wading through them. I mean, to me, this was the magic that you know we wanted to save, and that's what I always thought we wouldn't be able to do. I thought even if we could save the High Line, how do you capture this kind of feeling? And like right now, we're alone. It's just us up here. And so that was always part of the magic, this sort of illicit feeling of being, you know, it's just this private garden, you know, right in the middle of New York. And that was always, you know, even right until we opened, I love the designs, but I was always secretly fearful that I wouldn't like it as much as what was up there, that I would always secretly be sad that we had to sacrifice this wild landscape. But you know what? It's been so made me so happy is I like the new part better. And it's, I love the design, I love the planning, but again, it's the people. And so what you don't have when you're up here like now is the people. And to me, that's where the real magic comes from, is the design influences the way people interact and changes their feeling, their perception of the city, and I think their perception of each other. I always notice that, you know, when you're up on the Highline, you see people holding hands. And you don't see that. I noticed that. I started thinking about it, and I was like, oh, you don't see that just in people walking down the street. And, you know, it's just not, New Yorkers don't do it. But, you know, on the High Line, they hold hands. And so I think that's, to me, the testimony of it really working.
Joshua David and Robert Hammond, who wrote High Line, the inside story of New York City's Park in the Sky, on top of the unfinished section of the High Line, above where? Where are we?
30th and 10th Avenue.
Above 30th and 10th Avenue. Thanks, you guys, so much for this wonderful tour. It's been
great. It's been great doing it. Thank you for coming.
Thanks for coming up.
Thanks for listening to this special podcast of Weekends on All Things Considered. We post a new episode every Sunday featuring highlights from our shows over the weekend. Subscribe on iTunes or at npr.org/weekendATC.
Thank you.